I want to thank you all for coming this morning to our panel, Shaping the Ache of Grief into the Beauty of Art. Before we begin, I want to acknowledge the grief that many of us feel in this moment, in this room, as war is raging in the Middle East. It can be hard to bear witness to so much pain in the world and not feel able to help. I also want to acknowledge the death yesterday of a great local poet, Louise Gluck, and I want to quote from her poem, Wild Iris. At the end of my suffering, there was a door. Hear me out, that which you call death, I remember. Today, we will hear from three different writers who each remember death in their own ways in three powerful memoirs. Melanie Brooks is the author of A Hard Silence, One Daughter Remaps Family, Grief, and Faith When HIV/AIDS Changes It All, and Writing Hard Stories, celebrated memoirists who shape art from trauma. She teaches at Northeastern University and at Bay Path University's MFA program. She holds an MFA in creative nonfiction from the University of Southern Maine's Stone Coast program and recently completed a certificate of narrative medicine at Columbia University. Laura Carney is the author of My Father's List, How Living My Dad's Dream Set Me Free. Her work has appeared in the Washington Post, the Associated Press, The Hill, People Magazine, Guideposts, Good Housekeeping, among other places. And Ann Pinkerton is the author of Were You Close? A Sister's Quest to Know the Brother She Lost. Her essays and poems have appeared in Hippocampus Magazine, Modern Loss, River Teeth, and the anthology The Pandemic Midlife Crisis, Gen X Women on the Brink, among other publications. She holds an MFA in creative nonfiction from Bay Path and studied poetry at Hampshire. I'm going to, before we begin asking questions, and we will have time for questions from all of you at the end, I'm going to ask each author to read a selection from their book, and then I'll ask a question of each of those authors after their selection, and then ask questions that'll pertain to the three of them. So first, Melanie, could you read a selection from A Hard Silence?
Yes, and I need to apologize for my voice. I am getting over acute laryngitis. This is the best voice day I've had so far, so I'm really happy. It doesn't hurt. It sounds painful, but it is not, so just to let you know. So I'm reading from a chapter. My father was infected with HIV in 1985 when I was halfway through grade 8. And we moved across the country 4 weeks later. And I'm reading from a chapter that kind of occurs right in that time period. And it's called The Language of Tragedy. And I've just come in from lunch to my social studies class, just to let you know. Something's happened. Mr. Collins began, his voice thick with the weight of whatever he was about to say. Dread lurched into my stomach. I clamped down hard on my back teeth, gripped my hands together in my lap, and waited. About 30 minutes ago, when the space shuttle launched from Cape Canaveral in Florida, something happened. He struggled to extend his words to the specifics. There was some kind of malfunction, an explosion. His voice cracked. What kind of explosion? A boy whose name I couldn't remember asked, his question tinged with alarm. A catastrophic one, Mr. Collins said gently, and his eyes reddened. The news reports are saying that everyone on board is presumed dead. A few gasps erupted around the room, and I scanned the faces of my classmates, each one shadowed with a mixture of shock and sadness. Just the day before, Mr. Collins was telling us about how excited he was to see a teacher, not just any teacher, a social studies teacher, he proudly emphasized, travel to space for the first time. It was Krista McAuliffe, the New Hampshire high school teacher chosen to be the first participant in the NASA Teacher in Space program and the first private citizen to join an expedition, and her presence on the seven-person crew of the Challenger that made this launch unique and captured our collective interest in Canada, too. It's such a terrible tragedy, Mr. Collins said. I'll be honest, I'm feeling pretty bad about it all. I'm sure you guys must be feeling some of that too. If you want to talk about it, we definitely can. Do you think the astronauts' families watched it happen? Nicole asked from her seat next to me, alarm shaking her voice. Until her question, my mind hadn't traveled beyond the seven people on board of the shuttle and what they'd experienced, but now all I could think about was how terrible it must have felt for the spectators on the ground to witness the disaster. TV footage I'd see replayed again and again over the next few days would make those thoughts real, as the camera's lens not only captured the explosion and the forked plumes of smoke and fire against the blue sky, but close-up images of people in the crowd as the horrific recognition of what they were seeing registered on their faces. I know they were, Mr. Collins answered, and I know that a lot of students in the U.S. were watching the launch live from their classrooms. Mrs. McAuliffe's students were. Her whole school was. That kind of grief is hard to think about. It's such a huge loss. His words petered out into another uncertain quiet. The air in the room had shifted, a new heaviness saturating the space. I felt it in my body, in my limbs, adding to the weight that was already there, pressing hard against unnamed feelings I'd been carrying around for weeks. But now, these words Mr. Collins was using, tragedy, grief, loss, gave me, for the first time, a language I could attach to them. My family had suffered an explosion, too. Our charted path had been obliterated by the news of my father's HIV infection, and I felt lost in the aftermath, trying but failing to recognize who we now were. We'd become invisible in this new city, no longer known by the reputation of our name and my father's good work. In so many bewildering ways, our life had shrunk. Our rental was a fraction of the size of the sprawling split-level house we'd left behind in Moncton. Cramped with outdated furniture that wasn't ours and surrounded by unfriendly neighbors, nothing about it felt like home. Mark didn't even have a real bedroom, but had settled instead for some space of his own in the windowless basement. I missed my rainbow room, my big yard bordered by the dense woods. These days, my mind was a frightening place, too often occupied by awful images of what might be ahead for us, for Dad. I longed to see Dad's face light up the way it used to when he'd swoop in for dinner, in between surgeries, eager to hear about our days and energized by the challenge and excitement of his own. In his new job, he spent dreary hours entombed in a quiet room, sitting at a desk, reading files, and trying to understand his new administrative work. At the end of each day, he seemed faded somehow. Mom was doing everything she could to keep us busy, to help us settle in, to create some semblance of normal in circumstances that were anything but. She was hyper-focused on finding music teachers for my brothers and me, enrolling us in swimming lessons and planning weekend outings. In contrast to Dad, she was in constant motion, an anxious undercurrent moved beneath her actions, and there were unsettling moments when the reassuring picture she was trying to paint over our situation showed its cracks. This week, she'd handed over the car keys to Mark, who wasn't yet 16 and didn't have a driver's license, and allowed him to chauffeur my younger brother David and me the 10 minutes on the four-lane highway to our schools before driving himself to the high school. And yet, I said nothing, swallowing hard against my unasked questions, doing what I was expected to do, because no one was pausing to talk to me about any of it. But as I sat in the classroom and listened to Mr. Collins talk about the Challenger disaster, the sadness and confusion around me bumped against the churning feelings inside, and everything felt unsettled. "It makes me want to cry," Stephanie said. I expected somebody to laugh, maybe one of the boys, but nobody did. Instead, her words were met with murmurs of agreement. "Of course it does," Mr. Collins said. He picked up the box of tissues from his desk and rose to his feet. Walking over to Stephanie, he extended it toward her. She took one and gave him a small, grateful smile. "It's a terrible, terrible tragedy," he said again. "It makes me want to cry too." This time, he didn't brush away the tears. Watching him, my own eyes filled. I was surprised to see a grown-up talk openly about his feelings. This, too, was unfamiliar territory. Yet unlike the other episodes of the last few weeks, I didn't wish this one away. As late January's white light sliced through the window, casting shards across my desk, I didn't speak. I couldn't separate all of my messy feelings into something concrete about the day's events, but I listened closely and leaned into the collective sadness, depositing some of my own there too, if only for a while. I relaxed my hands and loosened my jaw. A soft sigh brushed past my lips. Thank you.
Thank you, Melanie. Before we move on to our other speakers, I wanted to ask Melanie, about you say in that passage how unfamiliar it was for adults to share their feelings. And the title of your book is A Hard Silence. And so I just wonder if you could, talk about how you chose that title and the role of silence in your experience of grief.
Sure. So the context, obviously, for this story is the HIV/AIDS epidemic of the 1980s and early 90s. However, the bigger question that kind of sits over this story is the question of the impact of silence. My father was infected in 1985, and he lived for 10 years before he died of AIDS-related complications in 1995. And for almost that 10-year period, we kept his illness a secret. So from the time I was 13 until I was 23, this biggest thing that was happening in my world was something I wasn't allowed to talk about. And so the story is really looking at that concept of what happens when we aren't allowed to speak in the face of pain, in the face of grief, in the face of suffering? And then how do we step out of that and learn to be authentic now? The title, A Hard Silence, actually came from the book of a friend, a writer I know. His name is Kim Stafford, and he has a book called 100 Tricks Every Boy Could Do, How My Brother Disappeared. And in one of his chapters, he talked about the hard silences in his family. And I went to him when I read his book, and I said, Kim, do you think I could use that? And he was like, use it away. And so that's where it actually originally came from.
Thank you. And also, I just want folks to know just a detail about Melanie's story. Her father was a surgeon, and he contracted HIV when he had a heart attack, and it was a blood transfusion he had in Canada. It was a tainted blood supply. And so the role of stigma in the world in 1985 around AIDS was so great that he confined the family to silence. So I want to ask Laura to please read an excerpt from her book, My Father's List.
Sure. This is working, right?
Okay. Yeah.
I haven't spoken yet, so I wasn't sure. I'm just going to read the beginning of my book. We were visiting my brother in Salem, Massachusetts, when we found it. As we gathered around Dave's granite-topped kitchen island, catching up on his wedding plans, my future sister-in-law, Jamie, went into their bedroom to retrieve something. Oh yeah, my brother said, I wanted to show you this. When she returned, her long blonde hair matching the walls of the rustic kitchen, she was holding a small brown suede pouch with a drawstring. She turned it upside down and out tumbled a silver ring and a driver's license, along with three pieces of folded notebook paper. We found it when we were unpacking, Dave said. Do you know about this? I unfolded the papers and started reading. At the top of the first page was things I would like to do in my lifetime, in my dad's handwriting. He wrote the list when he was 29, covering both sides of each page. The first item said, I would like to live a long, healthy life at least to the year 2020. The last said he hoped to dance at his grandchildren's weddings. But both those goals were rendered impossible on August 8, 2003, the day he was killed by a distracted driver. That summer, I was 25, pursuing my dream of becoming a writer in New York. My dad had encouraged this more than anyone, so I knew I couldn't give up on it. He wasn't there when I accomplished my goal of working at a women's magazine 8 years later. And he wasn't there 5 years after that when I needed him to walk me down the aisle. But on that afternoon in my brother's kitchen, I felt connected to him as we chuckled at his often indecipherable handwriting. I wondered aloud if he'd kept the list his whole life. He'd never told us about it. But then Dave remembered the World Series game he'd checked off. Look, he said, he even wrote the score. As proof, I asked. Then something strange happened. We realized that many of his want-to-dos were things we'd already done. I did that, I cried about number 31, get my picture in a national magazine. And you did that, I reminded my brother when we saw he'd wanted to record 5 songs. Dave recorded his with his a cappella group in college. All in all, there were 13 items we'd accomplished. Not a small dent, considering he wrote down 60. But in my father's entire lifetime, he'd only checked off 5. Item number 12 said, give my children the most love, the best education, and best example I can give. He never checked that one off, but he should have, because it's the reason I did this. I decided to finish the list. As soon as my husband, Stephen, suggested it, I saw my dad in my mind's eye, smiling and nodding.
Thank you. So, thank you so much, Laura. And you worked to, how many items were on the list?
There were 54 left when we found it.
And you have now completed all 54 items on his list?
In December I was done.
Incredible.
Thank you.
And the items on the list were everything from swim the width of a river to jumping out of a plane?
Yeah, it's fun. Everybody loves swim the width of a river, I think, because it's so poetic, right? My dad was a writer, too.
What I found very interesting about your book is in the process of finding this list and completing this list, you wrote that you felt it set you free, the discovery of this. And I just wonder if you could sort of unpack that idea of how completing your father's list changed your relationship with him or your grief or yourself.
That's a really good question. The way that my father died was sudden and tragic, and I think because of the nature of the death, it made it very difficult for everyone I knew to talk about it. And by the time we found that list, and I had just gotten married, and my brother was just about to get married, you know, it was almost like re-triggering this grief and this realization, like, oh, this thing happened that happened. It was almost like things are backwards. You know, this was supposed to happen later. Instead, it happened when we were in our 20s, and now we're both going to get married, and we don't get to have him being here. And, you know, I started realizing, I couldn't keep going through my life not talking about him. You know, I couldn't keep suppressing my memories of him just because it was tragic or it was scary. And that so much of what I now associated with him was that day when he died. You know, I had become somewhat phobic myself. I think I started developing this way of going through life where I was very afraid that something might happen to me or something might happen to someone else in my family. And it changed me. You know, I almost like lost my innocence at a very young age. So finding the list and getting to do these things, like, you know, I think he said go skydiving at least once. I always think that's so funny because he thought he would do it a few times. You know, or ride a horse fast or surf in the Pacific Ocean. There's a lot of travel items. Visit Vienna, visit New Orleans, visit San Diego. I had this excuse to go on these adventures at the age of 38, you know, do these fun things. And my husband, luckily, was all for it. I always remind him it was your idea. Because he works from book publishing. As soon as he saw the list, he's like, you've been wanting to write a book about your dad. This is great. This is really going to be a good way to do it. But, you know, even more than that, we didn't really get to have my dad there giving me away at my wedding, but we did get to have his input in our very early married life because his list was now guiding our early adventures together as a married couple. And as I made myself do each of these sometimes somewhat death-defying adventures, sometimes these feats that scared me a little bit, I think what was happening for me was I was now getting this opportunity to work through my trauma, to work through that fear of what if something happens to me and what if something happens to my family, because I was doing something totally different but also almost equally scary, and I was accomplishing it and surviving it, and not only surviving it but having a really good time and really quite enjoying myself. And as that would happen, I would remember this is what he was about. Mm. You know, this is what he taught me as a very young girl, is that life is about having fun. Life is about relishing the fact that, like, life, what I always like to say is life is a gift, it's not a given. Mm-hmm. So now it was starting to almost flip the way I looked at his death. And instead of being so focused on August 8th, that day that he died, I now started seeing the number 54 everywhere, 54 list items, 54 miles in the desert that I went on a bicycle. 54 was the final score at the Rose Bowl, one of the list items I did. I went to Super Bowl 54 for one of the list items. And it finally started to occur to me, you know, the number 54, if you look at it in Roman numerals, like they had it at the Super Bowl, it spells out L-I-V. Mm. It spells out live. Mm. And I realized that's what he would want me to do. He wanted me to live my life. He didn't want me to be stuck on the day that he died. So that's really what it was. It occurred to me that I could celebrate him and give him a legacy by living. And it didn't have to be about, you know, focusing too much on the day when my whole family's lives changed.
Thank you so much. That was beautiful.
Thank you.
Anne, can you please read an excerpt from your memoir, Were You Close?
Surely. As a slight preface, I'll just say my brother David was 12 years older than me and was a successful radiologist and a really accomplished outdoor adventure guy. He was a mountain bicyclist and an ultramarathon racer and then was the captain of his own adventure racing team. So he was very heroic to me from the very beginning, but certainly up into the end. This is the second chapter of the book, The Dot Stopped. In retrospect, the way David died was completely predictable. In a way, it was even poetic. If I were writing the perfect way for him to go out, it might be just the way it happened, except for the guesswork and the worry. My musician husband, Peyton, was on the road in the middle of a national tour, but was playing our town on a Thursday in September of 2008. I was thrilled to see him and his bandmates, some of whom I'd been friends with for many years. Wearing a sundress to celebrate the leftover summery heat, I'd happily bounced into the club for soundcheck so I'd get a little extra time with everyone. I helped sling t-shirts at the merch table and danced through every song. The show was joyous. We gave goodbye hugs to the group and headed home for our one night together, high on the concert and the camaraderie. 20 minutes past midnight, our phone rang. We wouldn't normally have been up at that time, but we were wide awake that night. I looked down at the caller ID on the cordless receiver and recognized the number as my mother's. I showed it to Peyton as if I needed him to confirm what I was seeing, because it was so odd that anyone, especially she, would be calling at that time. I didn't answer. The ominous feeling of getting that call too late momentarily paralyzed me. We looked at each other for a few seconds, perplexed. She hung up before the call went to voicemail. But seconds later, it rang again. That time I answered right away. "Oh, hi, I'm sorry it's so late," Mom said. "I wasn't sure if I should call or not. I don't know what to think." "What's going on?" I asked. "Well," she started and then hesitated. After a too long pause, she finally said, "David's missing." And then jumbled fragments of a story began to spill out. He was in Colorado with Cheryl and the kids, but they went home yesterday, and he stayed to hike some of the mountains on his own. She called Tommy when she didn't hear from him. Someone else has the GPS. I don't know. And, well, it stopped moving. You know the little dot that shows where he is? It just stopped. I guess it hasn't moved in a while. She sounded nervous, but not too nervous. "They've called search and rescue, but it's probably too dark to look right now." I did a quick calculation, counting backward across the time zones, trying to get closer mentally. It would be 10:30 p.m. in Colorado. I sketched a fuzzy picture in my mind from the few details she had told me. My brother's girlfriend, Cheryl, her daughter, and our 7-year-old nephew, Christopher, Tommy's son, had been camping with him on a trip, but now David was alone, likely on a mountain. He had a tracking device on him. Disparate members of the family who never spoke to each other directly were now discussing things and passing them along like a bad game of telephone. It wasn't clear what the real full story was, but there was enough concern to warrant a search. The little dot on the GPS, the one that hadn't moved in a while, that was my brother. Mom said she'd call back as soon as she heard something more and that she was considering flying to Colorado in the morning. Cheryl and David's adventure racing teammate Sean, neither of whom she had met before in person, were talking about going too. She apologized again for calling because it was late, but we were up.
Thanks. Thank you so much, Anne. Anne, the title of your book, Were You Close?
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if you could explain that title and also tell me if you felt you got closer to your brother in the process of writing this book.
Yeah. The question was something I got asked over and over again. And it really plagued me because I thought, of course we are. He's my brother. We love each other. But the reality was more complicated. We had this age gap. We lived far apart. We didn't talk all the time. Who was I to say what close meant? And really, how do you even define closeness? But also, more importantly, like, what does it matter if you're grieving? But it really set me up to feel like I was somehow undeserving. Because this question came a lot of times in companion with, was he married? Did he have kids? How's your mom? Mm-hmm. And no one was really asking me how I was. And I was a complete train wreck. I mean, our whole family was shattered. The sudden death thing is just this whole overlay that, you know, just sort of tips your whole sense of the world on its side. And so I felt very put off every time people asked it because I realized I didn't know how to answer. Mm-hmm. And I felt like the way that I answered was going to change their reaction to me mm-hmm. and give me a sense of whether or not they felt that I was entitled to be as upset as I was. And so it became kind of a through line in the book, investigating this question. What does it mean to be close to somebody? And I realized all the things that I didn't know about my brother when he died, primarily why it was worth it to him to take these risks that were so life-threatening, I mean, that cost him the ultimate. And so I used that as really my kind of tool to dig into who he was, and it meant I went down the path of reading all the outside magazines I could get my hands on and all of the adventure books I could possibly read and reading about sibling loss and why I felt so alone in it and why it's called disenfranchised grief to the few people who study it. And so it was a way of sort of consoling myself through the process of grieving while I was feeling so isolated. And yes, absolutely, I got extremely close to him through the writing and the living of doing this book. And it's a strange thing to be really close to somebody who's dead. But I have a very tight relationship with my brother right now.
Thank you. Thank you, Anne. So I now have a question for all three of you. And this is about the process of writing this memoir. I mean, one of the challenges for people who think about writing about loss and grief is like, am I ready to go there? Like, you know, each of you, you're writing about some of the most painful memories of your life and having to spend time there. Melanie, before you wrote A Hard Silence, you had put together a book, Writing Hard Stories, where you interview memoirists like André Debus and Edwige Dondekut to ask how they...
And Alicia Abbott.
how they told their stories. And for example, was there any advice to that you turned to help you write? And then if each of you could talk about what sort of helped you get through those most difficult parts of the writing.
Sure. So when I started writing this book, it was 20 years after my dad had died. I kind of thought I was ready. I thought, you know, I'd lived through the wake of his death. I'd kind of gotten to the point where I was like, oh, I think I'll write a book about it. As soon as I started writing, I realized that there was so much of the grief and loss that I hadn't even ever looked at before. And in many ways, like a lot of people talk about writing, you know, hard things as being re-traumatizing. I think for me, it was almost traumatizing for the first time because it was the first time I ever really had a chance to acknowledge what I was actually experiencing during that 10-year block of time. And so when I started writing, I was really caught off guard by how difficult it was and psychologically taxing that it was. And I, you know, this sounds hyperbolic, but I would sometimes be sitting in front of the computer screen. The screen would be blank. I'd have my fingers poised, and I'd be thinking about what I was going to write. And I thought, if I start typing, I'm literally going to die. Like, that's how it felt. It was that intense. And so the project that ended up being writing Hard Stories was a very selfish endeavor on my part. I was reading all of these wonderful memoirs for my MFA program that I was in. And I kept thinking, like, how did this person write about, you know, this really horrific thing? You know, I read Alicia's book and I thought, how did Alicia write about the loss of her dad to HIV and, you know, this single dad she'd lived with since she was two, you know? And I kept thinking, like, how did they get to that place where they could have a book? And I thought, well, maybe if I could just have a little chat with them, I'll feel a little better, you know? And what ended up happening was, first of all, I discovered that the writers that I encountered were extremely generous people. And so not only did they say, you know, I'll answer a few of your questions, they invited me to their homes. They invited me, you know, to be with them and talk to them. And I ended up having such beautiful conversations with them that I kept thinking, like, if somebody had handed me those conversations at the start of this process, I would have felt a whole lot better about, you know, kind of the psychological turmoil. I would have just kind of turned to the person next to me and been like, oh yeah, they said that was what was going to happen, right? And so I realized, like, I wanted to share the insights. And so in answer to your question, it was almost like an oxygenation process. Like every time I sat down and talked to another writer, it gave me a little more breath, that gave me a little more courage, that sent me back to my writing desk and let me keep writing. So...
thank you. What about for you, Laura?
You know, this is a very surreal moment for me because I'm only here because she wrote that book. You know, I mean,
it's gonna make me cry.
This exists because she was brave enough to interview people like you. And when I started writing my book, about a year into doing the list, I bought Melanie's book. And what I would do is I would say, okay, every time I finish writing a chapter, I can read one of her chapters. And then it would make me feel not alone, you know, like what you just said, if only I could have had those stories. Like, I got to be that person who had those stories, and it really meant a lot to me because it made me feel like this is a thing other people have also gone through, and it emboldened me to write about my truest experience because I knew somehow that other people also had somehow had their own version of this out there in the world. You know, my experience of writing this story, you know, I think it's interesting what you just said, because I went through this too. You said it felt like you were going to die. And I think what's probably true is that you did. The version of you that existed before you wrote this book had to go away. And it felt like that was happening to me as well. And the reason for that, I think, is because I learned at age 25, and I had just moved to New York City, you know, I was doing the things a 25-year-old in New York City does, going out to bars, meeting new people, going on job interviews, except I'm telling everybody about my dad who was just killed in a car crash. And I would feel very alienated when I would meet people, and I learned very quickly, okay, Laura, stop talking about this. You know, like this needs to not be part of your narrative. And by the time this list showed up in my life, and I made the choice to go after these items, I had constructed a persona of who I was going to present to the world that I thought would be acceptable. And sometimes I think I almost became someone who was overcompensating, right, for this thing that I viewed as a trauma that was, you know, as disrespectful almost as it sounds. I was sort of embarrassed of it because it made me feel like a victim too. And that was the last, as someone who was already diagnosed with depression as a teenager, which I also ended up writing about in the book, that was the last thing I wanted anyone to see me as. I wanted people to see me as strong. So as I started writing this book, you know, there were two things that were happening. One, I'm now letting go of this very, very carefully, which I didn't know at the time, but very carefully orchestrated armor that I had started to wear. I'm having to now put it down, right? But the other thing that was happening was I'm still doing this bucket list because I wrote it simultaneously with doing it. And there were certain parts of my life that started to fall apart as I was doing the list. Mm-hmm. Like I lost my job in the second year of doing it. I was laid off. It wasn't due to anything that I had done. It was just a restructuring of the company. But if that had happened, I had worked there for 7 years. And if I had lost my job at a woman's magazine at any other time, I would have been devastated. But instead, I was so happy because I thought, now I have time to write my book. You know, like this is great. And as I started to make this shift from the copy editor at a women's magazine whose job in this ivory tower in New York is so important to her, and I would tell everybody I met all the time, oh, I work in magazines, you know, like it made me important, right? As I was shifting from that person to the person who's doing her father's bucket list and is now writing a book about it, I wasn't really losing parts of an identity that were important. You know, I wasn't losing things that I actually even needed. What instead was happening was, like I said, I'm taking off this armor because I'm supposed to become somebody else. I needed to, it's like Joseph Campbell would say all the time, when you follow your bliss, doors open to you where before there were only walls. And it became a very uncertain and faith-driven experience for me, and that was not the way I had ever lived before. I always really wanted a sense of control, and like I knew what was going to happen next. And now there were so many list items where I would be in the middle of one of them and think like, oh my gosh, like talk with the president, how am I gonna make that happen? You know, and there would be so many obstacles along the way. So as I learned to just have faith and make myself keep doing it, because I had to, right? Like write and have a few novels published, that's item number three on the list. I couldn't back out this time. I had wanted to write about this experience since the age of 25, and now at the age of 39, I'm finally doing it. And I really think it was just because I needed to honor this. You know, I needed to celebrate what it means to have dreams in the first place, because I think that's when we're following our dreams, that's when we feel the most alive. And even though I was doing it for him, what ended up happening was I'm now also doing it for me. And then I wrote my own list in year three of this. So instead of living my life now constantly afraid whenever I see someone on their phone driving a car, I'm now living a life where, yes, that might be happening, but I'm talking about how important it is to follow your intentions, to write down your intentions, to actually enjoy yourself while you're here. And my hope is that, you know, because I made that effort and I put that into a story, that when people read that story, the message might sink in anyway.
Thank you. Anne.
Well, I often teach workshops called Writing Through Loss, and one of the things that I really emphasize for people who are interested in doing this kind of work is taking care of yourself through the process, because it is very hard. It can feel, as Melly said, re-traumatizing. And I couldn't have done this without a bereavement writing group, which is actually part of the process in the book, mm-hmm. and an amazing therapist, in addition to a really supportive partner and amazing friends. But because it felt so isolating to be going through this grief, and that whole sense of like feeling like it's too much for everybody at some point, you're wearing it all over, but mm-hmm. in order to function in the world, you've got to kind of tuck it away. Yeah, I really, really relied on my bereavement writing group and my therapist to do a lot of processing for a really long time. So I tell people doing this work to really take breaks, give yourself grace. There were a lot of tears shed. You know, I had to take a lot of breaks. I had to put it in a drawer for a year. You know, it took a long time. And I decided it was okay that it took the time it took. And that if you have a spiritual practice or yoga or whatever, that you like, you really take care of yourself while you do it, because it is very, very painful to go through. It's also the most rewarding thing I've ever done. I think the clarity that I found in doing it, and the ability to share my really cool brother with people mm-hmm. has been so meaningful. And so I really encourage people who are interested in doing it to do it, but to do take care, because it is very painful to go back into those areas. I also really believe there's this thing that Abigail Thomas says about if you don't deal with your dark things, like they continue to haunt you, and I'm not going to quote her well, but she talks about pulling the dark things out into the light. And it does sort of take some of their power away. I mean, taking all of that pain out of my head and heart and putting it on the page and gave me some control over this really uncontrollable feeling. That's one of the really powerful things about writing, is that you can take it. It's like the title of this panel, for God's sakes, I just realized. You're shaping, you're taking this terrible thing. It's kind of, I mean, it's very Pollyanna to say, like, lemon's lemony, but you are taking something terrible and making something of meaning out of it. And that can really be incredibly empowering.
Gosh, I have so many other questions, but we actually are going to open up to questions for the audience. I'm sure a number of you have some thoughts. If you want to just raise your hand, I can repeat the question. Yes.
Or
there's a microphone. Yeah, I'm sorry. Well, I think just for the folks in the back, maybe.
All right.
Okay,
it's coming to you.
Here you go.
Thank you. Anne, you used this phrase disenfranchised grief, and I kind of have some sort of like concept of that, but can you define it for me? Because
absolutely.
It seems like that would be grief that pulls you apart from your community, which is. Yeah,
that's certainly part of it. So Kenneth Doka, who is a grief expert and author, actually coined this phrase, and it was part of what I uncovered when I was researching sibling loss and why nobody talks about it, because we all have brothers and sisters. Most of us have brothers and sisters. And, you know, the whole sibling relationship is actually very understudied, and I think it's part of why sibling loss ends up sort of falling to the bottom of a hierarchy of grief in our culture, where there are books about spouses and parents and children out the wazoo. And I mean, these are obviously huge, important losses to be discussing. There's almost nothing out there about brothers and sisters. It was part of what compelled me. So, disenfranchised grief is defined really largely as a grief that is unacknowledged that way, that society doesn't think is such a big deal. Somehow this person that you spent all this formative time with growing up with, who's the only person who knows your family intimately, the way you grew up in it, somebody you expect to help take care of your parents as they age, like go through all this stuff with you, is suddenly gone, and yet this was the annoyance of the questions about was he married, did he have kids, how's your mom? I was like, hi, I'm right here. You know, so it was that sense of really just feeling like I wasn't entitled to be upset about this, that somehow I was just a sister.
And that I think that can compound the sense of grief, is like, I'm feeling this, but now am I allowed to feel this? Is something wrong with me for feeling this? And I think, you know, and that some there's a lot of a sense of grief, you know, right? I mentioned at the top of the program, like, we feel a lot of grief around us, and we sometimes just witnessing other people deep in grief are like, what am I allowed to feel? Mm-hmm. What is appropriate? And you know, and sometimes guilt, like, I shouldn't be feeling this way, comes up and sort of complicates that grief. Any other questions? Yes, the woman in the pink. And then we'll go over here.
Such a wonderful panel. Thank you so much. And thank you for writing these books, because as a nurse that's taking care of people at end of life, I started my career around the time of HIV and ended it taking care of people dying of COVID. Mm-hmm. And there was a huge silence. And so I find you all to be incredibly courageous. And I was just wondering, grief is something that's, you know, there's a lot of commonalities to it, but there's a lot of, it's lonely. There's a lot of personal, like your relationship to your father and your brother is very, very personal. So I was just wondering if you got commentary or feedback or criticism even about that wasn't my experience, or in some way, did you have to defend your experience at all?
Melanie, will take
I'm going to jump in on that and just say, I think sometimes anybody who's experienced grief in our kind of current culture, we struggle with how to support people in grief. And I think one of the things that we really don't do well is allow people space and time. Because for us, you know, and it's all good intentioned. We want the person to feel better, right? And I think, you know, for me, I was experiencing intense, intense grief writing this book 20 years after my dad's death, and probably more intense than at the time that he died. And I think, I don't know that anybody came out and questioned and said to me, you know, aren't you over that yet? But I do think that that was a question that was kind of hanging over me a little bit, that sense of, like, I should be past it now. And I mean, even within my own family, you know, why was I writing this book at this particular point in time about our family's experience 20 years after my dad's death? You know, the rest of them had gone through it. They weren't writing books. So I think that was a little bit of the pushback that I felt. And so I think that, you know, everybody's grief is different, but I also think that we live in a culture that makes it hard to grieve fully. Mm. You know, we praise people who are stoic in the face of grief. Like, think how many times you've heard, like, oh, she didn't even cry at the funeral. She was so strong, you know? And so we kind of praise the things that create that distance, I think, from grief. And so I think it's important for us, and why, you know, all four of us have written books that deal with grief, is because we're putting it out there to kind of open space for these conversations.
I can answer that too, if you like. My, you know, when you know, as Dan, or as Melanie mentioned, she wrote hers 20 years after her father died, and I had a similar experience. I also wrote my book 20 years after my father died. But I think for me, what was happening there was I had just gotten married, and I was anticipating my own, you know, there's something about getting married, right? That it's like I'm separating from my family of origin now, and I'm going to have my own family. And what is that going to look like? And I think what was happening for me was that when my father died so suddenly, and nobody knew why he was in that intersection. Nobody knew where he was. And, you know, for me, that triggered when my parents divorced when I was six. And it started bringing up all of those feelings again. And I think a lot of the losses we experience in our lives tend to do that. They'll just trigger the previous losses. So it's like you're going to keep having loss upon loss upon loss until you deal with those original emotions. So I almost regressed in a way when I was 25 when that happened. And I started focusing solely on my career and on work, because when I was six and my dad left inexplicably, I found out the reason much later, I started focusing on school, and I became an overachiever. And I don't think in the end that my decision to do this bucket list and write about it was something that anybody in my family didn't want me to do, or necessarily felt that I was telling a story that was only my version of who he was and wasn't okay because they had their own versions of him. I think it was more, for me personally, I was kindred spirits with my father. I needed his guidance. I needed his advice. I needed to have some kind of understanding of the kind of life I was going to have as a creative person, and it was a life that I was repressing. I had no idea that I was going to be able to do these list items. I had no idea that I was going to be able to write a book. And my experience of my father now is that he's a spirit that is very much with me all the time, and that he's always guiding me. And I can ask him for advice whenever I want to. And I hear, you know, like I said, I saw him in my mind's eye. That was the first time that ever happened. and I feel very comforted by the fact that his spirit is still with me and still guiding me. And I definitely didn't have that feeling before, but that was something that I personally needed. So that's why, I mean, I do think I had almost a karmic attachment to the list, too, because he wrote it right when I was born. So it's almost like my entire childhood I was being shaped to one day do this. So for me, it was a calling. So I think my family gets that. But at the same time, are you okay?
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, I tried to be very aware as I was writing the book that I'm always just writing this from my own experience and my concept of him as a father. I don't know every element of his life. And actually, reading Melanie's book helped me with that a lot, because some of the memoirs that she interviewed would talk about that. You know, how much of this person do you get to talk about? So I really, as a journalist, tried to draw a very fine line. And even when there were, you know, things about his life that I was exploring, that felt like they were sensitive issues, I would join a support group and learn about that so I could write about that perspective that he hadn't necessarily shared with me.
We have some questions here. Can someone bring a microphone over? Thank you very much. And then in the back.
Hi, thank you. I'd just like to echo the thanks to all of you for your courage in writing these stories and putting them out there. And what I'd love to hear about from all of you or one or two of you is just a bit of your experience of actually writing the book and the time that it took. It's really helpful to hear sort of where you were in your life when you started writing and how distant that was from the actual experience of loss. And you mentioned you had to put it away in a shelf for a year, and I would just love to hear sort of how you moved through this, how quickly you just the length of time it took and just sort of a bit of the process of writing. Were you doing other things at the same time, sort of squeezing this in on the side, or had you embarked on this process as sort of the sole focus of your work and your time?
Maybe Laura?
Yeah. I'll take this to start. So my process was super messy. I didn't even know I was writing a book at first. And then I sort of got into it, and that's when I actually went back to grad school. So I was working full time. I was in grad school full time, and I was writing this book. So there was a lot going on. I had no social life. And then an early draft of this was my thesis when I was getting my MFA. And actually going back to grad school was something my brother always wanted me to do. So there's also this kind of sense of, I don't know, someone from the great beyond sort of nudging you along. And ended up being an amazing experience going back to grad school. But after I finished my thesis, I knew that it wasn't done. I knew the book wasn't done. I knew I had like a solid, big, big chunk of it. But there was something that just wasn't done. And weirdly, I graduated from grad school in 2016, literally put this in a drawer for a year. And then I was awarded my first writing retreat. And leading up to that, I actually lived at the end of the book. I mean, it was super weird. It was almost, there are parts of it that I'm tempted to say were scripted. It wasn't quite that. But I knew that I hadn't lived the whole story. And there's a thing with memoir where you have to decide where you cut it off. Like, what's the container of the story? Because I'm still living with my brother's death. So, you know, but this takes place over 10 years. And so it ends on the 10th anniversary of my brother's fall. In Colorado and going back to Colorado. It's not a spoiler. But yeah, it took a really long time. It was fits and starts. It was drafts and redrafts. And it was taking some really substantial breaks. So very inefficient way to write a book, but very necessary just for the way that the story was.
I just want to jump in and say that, you know, what has been interesting for me, so I started in 2013 and publishing in 2023. I wasn't writing that entire period, and there was a chunk of time in there where I was trying to find a publisher, which was a long and discouraging process for me. But when I think about timing, I never could have, and I actually, you know, flash forward in my epilogue and say this, that I never could have imagined that at the time that this book was coming out, we'd be post a worldwide pandemic that would make the story that I tell in these pages resonate in a different way than it would have had we not all been in an experience of facing isolation. Because I faced that alone, we faced it globally, right? But I think it allows readers to identify with the experience so much more closely.
Yeah, I felt the same thing. And when the pandemic started, I was like, oh my gosh, like, people are going to say too soon. Because now I have to write about a global pandemic. That's going to be chapter 13. Because I was, as like you were saying, like, I was still living the bucket list. And I started writing my book after the first year. I think I just had beginner's luck, and I got 14 items finished in the first year. So I started writing it, and I got an agent very early. Through the help of an editor I worked with at Good Housekeeping. And then that didn't end up being my agent later. I ended up changing to a different person and writing more of the book that I actually wanted to write. Full disclosure, that agent just like dropped me, basically. When I turned in my first draft, he's like, oh, this isn't what we talked about. You know, and that happens. It happens all the time. I was devastated when it happened, but, you know, he gave me very constructive criticism, and I had just been overwriting to try to impress him. So I went back to the drawing board, so to speak, and I changed the narrative, I changed the structure, I put flashbacks inside of the chapters where they belonged, and I just basically started writing the book I had always wanted to write, which before I had been too intimidated to do because I just kept thinking, you know, I'm a magazine copy editor. Like, what do I know? What do I know about writing a book? So I would say trust yourself if you're doing that, because the story that you want to tell that's in your heart is the story that it's supposed to be. But I think you also have to trust the process, because there would be some days where I really did want to get, you know, get to the writing, and it just wasn't going to come. I couldn't do it that day. And, you know, it's interesting. So much of my experiences with the list almost intertwined with the writing of the book, because one of the list items I got injured pretty badly doing, it was, I'm going to get this right, beat a number one seed in a tennis tournament was the list item. I thought it just said beat a number one seed in tennis. The word tournament had been covered because the notebook paper folded inside of the frame. So I thought I could do it in one day. So I went out there, and then I actually landed on the tendon of the tendon of the second toe on my left foot tore, and I had to go and have surgery a few months later after ignoring it for a few months. And what that meant was I was now stuck on the couch, not even able to walk for a couple of months. And I had been avoiding writing about my dad's funeral, and writing about the moment when I found out he had died, but now I couldn't go anywhere. I was stuck sitting on this couch, like, I couldn't run away from myself anymore, so that was why I was able to finally write about that. And what I found was very helpful was I created rituals for myself that made sense for me. You know, for most of my life, being diagnosed with ADD as a teenager, I was very paranoid about my being a night owl. I was like, this isn't normal, this isn't healthy. But with writing this book, if I had to stay up until 6 a.m., sometimes I had to stay up until 6 a.m. And that was just what it was requiring, almost like an elf in the middle of the night making the shoes, right? Like almost like what I'm writing is such a secret that it has to be in the veil of night when I do it. And luckily, I also have a very understanding husband who's sitting right over there who encouraged me to do this writing and kept almost liberating me from what I thought my role was supposed to be as a wife. And he would constantly remind me, I married you for you, and this is helping you to be you, so keep going. And, you know, one thing I found that was extremely helpful, and I don't know how many people here are into New Age kind of stuff, and it might seem kind of woo-woo to you, but I had these crystals that I got, and I would sage and smudge the crystals every time. I see you nodding your head. You know what I'm talking about. I would smoke them every time I started to write, and one of them was supposed to be for courage, you know, one of them was for an open heart, and one of them was for trusting your voice, and there was just something about the energy of these things that I felt like were keeping me company and helping me to be strong as I told the most difficult story of my life to tell.
I do want to jump in and just say, at a practical level, like, I had two kids that I was raising, I was teaching college, so I was not writing full time, and I think few of us could say that we had the opportunity to just be writing all the time. And in some senses, that's a gift, because it allows you to step away from the grief on the page. And just, I remember you saying that to me actually in our interview for Writing Hard Stories, that, you know, you have to go and make dinner and take your kids to soccer and, you know, like, you have to do the things of life. But it's that distraction that kind of pulls you out of your head and out of that grief, too.
Well, we are coming, unfortunately, to the close of our talk. I do want you to know that these three writers are selling their books outside if you want to get them signed and talk with them a little bit more. But my hope is that in this conversation can help, you know, shine light on just the naturalness of grief and the importance of sharing and not staying in silence. So everyone, please put your hands together and thank our panelists. Thank you also to the Boston Book Festival and to all of you for supporting the arts and festivals like this that are so important to the lifeblood of this city. So
thank you. And thank you to Alicia for being a beautiful moderator.
Thank you, Alicia.